A piece of dissatisfying but hard-earned truth for all of you 9-year-olds not in Sunday school this morning. And I hate to disappoint, but regardless of what you just heard Jesus say, you still have to wash your hands. Now I know that this is not what you wanted to hear, because it seems so plain. I mean, Jesus never refutes the fact that his disciples don't wash their hands. And it even looks as if he tries to change the subject. But there is something more at stake here. It only nominally has to do with the dirt on a disciple's hand. Because the Pharisees who challenged Jesus about the washing of hands were a religious body that parsed the rules of the Torah into nearly infinite details of cleanliness. But before we jump to condemn those OCD Pharisees again, we must remember that it's not that the Pharisees were trying to bury the commands of God. Instead, they were truly trying to use the Torah in all practices of life, from waking to sleeping. In fact, while sleeping as well. It's just that they took it a little too far away from the original intent. And then here comes this Jesus who seems to ignore the carefully crafted traditions that they have created as if the law did not matter to him. So what do you suppose might be the response of those who are the keepers of "this is the way that we've always done it"? Maybe. "And you thought you were one of us? We don't think so." Or in the text, "Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders?" Because really, these purity laws aren't so much about getting right with God, so much as they are about setting strict borders. It is important to know that the Jewish culture in the first century operated in the same fashion as all human societies do in this way. Because purity practices are a form of group boundary. They define who is in and who is out. And if this is then about who is in and who is out, who is clean and who is unclean, who is pure and who is impure, who is safe and who is unsafe, it sounds remarkably similar to our time and our place. Or as one scholar has said, one way to convey the power of the Jewish distinction between clean and unclean, perhaps, is to draw a parallel with authoritarian societies and organizations, where people can avoid all contact with a person who is under suspicion or who has been fired, so as not to endanger their own position. Because once I care for one who is outside of the boundary, I put myself at great risk. A few weeks ago, I was at the dentist for a regular checkup and cleaning, and I have to say, regardless of the pain and suffering that my dentist puts me through, I genuinely like him and am fortunate that he cares for our family's teeth. So lo, these weeks ago, it was somewhat of a shock to have this conversation with him. But to call it a conversation is actually overstating it a bit. Right? Because he was working away, several instruments at play, when he said, "How about that Obama's health plan?" To which I responded, "Huh." It's as if my dentist has the same conversational skill set as many waiters. You know, you're waiting just until you got this mouth of food, and they come with the, "Everything all right here?" Mm-hmm. Seeing that I couldn't say much, my dentist launched into a tirade about an interview he'd seen on TV with a woman who had 9 children and couldn't afford health care for them. 9 children, he exclaimed. Now, if she can't afford kids, why is she having them? Why should you and I pay for her kids' health care? Why indeed? I had so many responses flashing through my head, like, who can afford kids? Or what about that woman's elderly parents? Why are we paying for their health care? Or you don't think we already pay for their health care one way or another? But what I actually managed to say through the tools of modern dentistry was, "Huh." And now, I'm not going to lie, that man had some instruments of pain in my mouth. I felt a little bit gun-shy. And in this wariness, I don't believe that I'm alone. Because the tensions in this country over the past few months have risen to levels that are coming close to dangerous. Friends, and I mean this so deeply, it is exactly at points like this that the Epistle of James needs to be heeded. It is written, "You must understand this, my beloved. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. For your anger does not produce God's righteousness." Quick to listen, slow to speak. If this could only be our practice at the congressional town hall meetings. Hangings in effigy, refusing to engage our neighbors in humility, unwilling to know the best of what they say. Shouting down elected officials as a matter of strategy. If we are Christians, we must act like the beloved. This does not mean that we cannot express ourselves, just that we must continue to create the space to listen, then to speak. It means that there is no place for lies, half-truths, intentional distortions. These are aspects of that evil that comes from within, and it truly defiles, debases, destroys us as a people. Now, I preach this morning knowing that not everyone hearing these words will agree with them, and so I offer them in humility. I also offer them in the truest spirit of politics rather than partisanship. Remember that the root of the word politic is found in the Greek word polis, the city or state. And the polis was also a reference to the physical area of a city where the citizens would come together to debate the common good. It is in this sense, then, that I preach, speaking to engage what is the common good, rather than to be partisan, a word deriving from Italian or French, meaning to take part or a side in a battle. This discussion about who will be cared for in this country, a discussion unlike any other in a wealthy country around the world, this discussion should have little to do with which side of the congressional aisle one sits on. For compassion has no party affiliation. And so it wasn't really until some time later that my truest response to my dentist came to me, and it came in this form from the letter of James. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to care for orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained by the world. To care for orphans and widows in their distress. Now remember that orphans and widows were known throughout Scripture, as well as in the first century, as a group to be watched over, as well as a marker representing the least of these. They had little means to care for themselves financially and were beset by conditions far beyond their control. And so it was a bounden duty, a personal and communal responsibility to care for them. Indeed, the Hebrew prophets consistently say that the measure of a nation's righteousness and integrity is how it treats the most vulnerable. Now, before I continue, let me further clarify my intentions this morning. This is not intended to be a sermon about the merits of which plan might best reform the currently broken system. There are far better qualified observers than I. Whether coverage is offered by a single payer, the government of the United States, or through adding a public option to what exists, or by some creation yet known, this is not what I choose to discuss in this forum. Simply put, what the Holy Word is pulling me towards is the discussion of a moral imperative: that we as a nation care for all who are in need of healing. The trap that we often fall into, the trap that the Pharisees fell into in this gospel passage, is that we see another as the other. We try to maintain this false sense of purity, of cleanliness, of supposedly safe otherness by refusing to care for another. And that's why today I speak in the language of moral imperative. Because we can make no mistake, orphans and widows today are crying out in distress in this country. A former health insurance company, public relations director, Wendell Potter, recently described a scene that served as his own road to Damascus revelation. While visiting his parents in northeastern Tennessee, he heard about a health expedition in nearby Wise County, Virginia, offered by the Remote Area Medical Volunteer Corps. Mr. Potter described it this way: doctors and nurses and other medical professionals were volunteering their time to provide free medical care to people who lived in that poor area. Nothing could have prepared me for what I saw when I reached the Wise County Fairgrounds, where the expedition was being held. Hundreds of people had camped out all night in the parking lot to be assured of seeing a doctor or dentist when the gates opened. By the time I got there, long lines of people stretched from every animal stall and tent where the volunteers were treating patients. Treating. Attempting to heal people in animal stalls and tents. in the wealthiest country in the world, in a country in which we spend twice per capita on health care than that of any other nation. This is why I speak in the language of moral imperative, friends. Because what is happening in this country is not right. It is not just. It does not follow the path of the Good Samaritan. It does not care for orphans and widows in their distress. It is not keeping us unstained from the world. Our attempts to follow the human and very American tradition that I am not responsible for others cannot stand. To merely ask that the weakest, the least of these, pull themselves up by their bootstraps does not show God's righteousness. This is not the spirit that we've been given to live into. We are called to a higher calling. If indeed Anglican and Christian moral theology lives the present with the end in mind, and if, as one scholar has said, God's future is enacted as present neighborliness, then how can we continue to act as if those living in distress were not our neighbors to care for? How can we allow for our neighbors to be treated in animal stalls, if they are lucky, or bankrupt themselves through medical misfortune? How could it possibly be that we could wash our hands of them?